Hey friends, this is Noah. Just want to give you a heads up that the first 7.5 or so minutes of Tori's sermon, we were having some audio issues. And so I used some studio magic to make sure that you could understand what she was saying, but she might sound a little funky and robotic. So I apologize about that, but at around the 7.5 minute mark, you will hear her voice as it is. Just wanted to give you guys a heads up.
So a few years ago, I was put in charge of a large conference that was many months behind in planning. Conferences tend to be complicated affairs, the lining up of speakers, breakout rooms, meals, accommodations. It can be a lot. There's a lot of big picture stuff, like topics and theming, and then there's an unending number of small details. Everything from new boxes of Sharpies and finding a trash can put by the name tag table, to figuring out how to keep the lunch line moving and the format of people's slides. I was slipping in behind a talented team of academics who had scripted most, but not all, of the big pieces, and hardly any of the details have been attended to. Additionally, this particular conference was doubly challenging in that a good handful of the guests were international, and it was a multidisciplinary conference with a variety of scholars of religious and philosophical stripes. Theologians, Bible scholars, economists, philosophers, whatever, all coming to talk about some of the biggest big picture philosophical questions imaginable, and they didn't all think the same. There were senior scholars, junior scholars, and students, and they came from some of the most elite institutions on the planet and many places we've never heard of. A few weeks before the event, a nondescript box of books landed on my desk. There was no note, no nothing, just like 30 copies of a book, authored by one of our most famous international conference presenters. And we didn't know what to do with it. There wasn't any information about how to sell the books, who to give the profit to, how much we were supposed to sell them for. And the author, in addition to being a scholar, held a prominent position in a foreign government as a member of its royal family. Our communication was primarily with the scholar directly, not like an assistant or anything. And so we really didn't want to write him and ask, what do we do with these books? So we opted to give copies of the books to some of the scholars who were sitting on a panel with the author, as that's the best way we could figure out what to do. I put the box under my desk, and I didn't think about it again. That is, of course, until a few weeks later, when he was presenting at the conference and made reference to the books that he had sent us, and he did so to a full lecture hall. You have never seen a group chat light up with such electric speed as when he referenced the books. Comments like, we were supposed to sell them. What are we supposed to do? Hand him the cash? Do we give it to his driver? How much do we sell them for? And then once we started investigating, things like, there's no ISBN number. I can't find this book on the internet. Like, no sense of what we're supposed to do with it. I ran to the bookstore with a box of books under my arms and chatted up the manager on the situation. And by this point, it really felt like we had an international relations crisis on our hands. We wanted to offer friendship and hospitality to our esteemed guests, and yet we didn't have enough information or context to actually know what was appropriate in that moment. And for what it's worth, we were afraid that in selling the books without information about how much to sell them for, what to do with the money, that would be considered dubious profiteering and an unkind act to this member of the royal family in this country. And we are afraid that giving the books away for free would undervalue him as a scholar. So we ended up keeping them in the bookstore behind the counter, gave them away for free to anybody who asked about them. I still don't know if this was the correct protocol, but at the end of the day, I really don't think His Royal Highness cared. Thank God. Now, this story is unquestionably the most dramatic I have ever experienced that centers the practice of hospitality. I was actively and intentionally working to create an environment that would help the guest feel at home and welcomed. But the thing is, like so many conversations about hospitality, the actual focus of my story was not the guest. Did you notice? It was me, the host. And the work that I was doing to try and understand the intentions of someone who was very different from me. not the experience of a guest from another part of the world, walking into a room full of scholars, nearly all of whom identify with religious traditions that are or in some way have been hostile towards the guest's religion, scholarship, and way of life. Think about it. I mean, hospitality is a word we associate with tidy up living rooms and extra place settings at Thanksgiving. And let's be real, most of the time, cleaning up the living room is about ensuring that our guests think well of us, not the comfort and security of the person leaving their world behind to come to a place where they don't even know where the bathroom is. This morning's text is John's account of Jesus feeding the 5,000 men and also women and children with loaves and fishes. Jesus dialogues with his disciples. They consider a practical need, literally thousands of hungry people up on a mountain. They workshop the problem, ask questions, and ultimately Jesus performs a life-sustaining miracle through the multiplication of a humble meal of bread and fish. We'll talk about Jesus and his disciples, but I want to think about them primarily through the lens of the other main actors in the story. That is to say, the boy, the one who carried with him the loaves and fishes, and the large crowd who followed Jesus up the mountain. These were the anxious, tired, hopeful, curious, and hangry people nourished by Christ's miracle. Though there was no physical table on the mountain able to accommodate thousands, they literally broke bread together. They were received as guests and hosted by the Lord himself. This morning's talk is part of a sermon series, The Presence of God and the Work of the People. We're unpacking our Sunday morning liturgy, our order of service, the actions that we rehearse together as a community when we gather each week. These steps that we take coming to this place at 55 East Lake Avenue, or turning into the light stream, chatting, grabbing coffee, the call to worship, they are all part of welcome. They are relationship-building acts of love that communicate care and investment. Welcome is a component part of hospitality. It's the beginning of our liturgy as a church, and welcome is what we are looking at in the text today. Let's turn back to the text. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for them. To be clear, after this is after Jesus healed a man who had been ill for 38 years. A man who had been waiting at the pool of Bethesda, longing to get into the waters, was stirred,
longing for healing. Jesus said to this man who had been waiting for help for nearly four decades, "Stand up, take your mat, and walk." The man did, and Jesus quickly disappeared into the crowd. It was a miracle, but it was also the Sabbath, where such things as mat carrying were prohibited. And just for a second, let's consider what mat carrying is. It's something visual and public. It's not a situation where you're not sure what the dress code is, so you kind of dress. It can kind of go either way or stash your sweater in the car. You can't blend in when you are carrying a mat on a day when mat carrying is prohibited. And so it was an uproar. Jesus eventually found the man he healed and told him who he was, and then that man went around and told the people who Jesus was and who healed him and why he was carrying the mat. And this information lit a flame of question and judgment and curiosity. Among a few, it lit up murderous intent. Jesus was healing on the Sabbath, and in the conversation that followed, he called God his own Father, and it intensified all sorts of things. And so in John 6, when it says, after this, it means after the people were lit up with stories and the disorienting practice of miracles that happen in ways that violate the law, news traveling like telephone through the masses. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat there with his disciples. No wonder they were following him. No wonder he went up a mountain. Crowds can be exciting places. We work hard to get access and pay to be part of particular kinds of crowds. People stand in massive lines at Disney World with excitement, and they jump through hoops for tickets to a Taylor Swift concert. Well, they will descend en masse on many of the world's largest entertainment venues. Crowds are always vulnerable places, but it's where it's possible for something to get out of control, but they are especially vulnerable when the gathering is not joyous, when a needed resource is limited, and when people are desperate. These groups can fall prey to a dangerous leader or turn to aimless anarchic violence. I would imagine that the crowd present in John 6 was a little bit of a blend of all of these things. The text says a large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Surely in that crowd were desperate people hoping for a miracle, for themselves or for someone that they loved. A medley of physical ailments, broken hearts, economic distress, and every manner of complicated social relationship. Within this group of followers, both full of faith and desperate for a reason to hang on, were decided naysayers. These folks, the one whom chapter 5 says started persecuting Jesus, were unable to accept the miracles and the way that Jesus brought them, unwilling to accept the way his actions in places turned the law on its head. And of course, meshed between these two poles were curious explorers unsure of who to trust, what to believe, and so they were out to see with their own eyes who this Jesus is and discern what is good. These attitudes and orientations were held by working parents, enslaved peoples, teachers, children, religious leaders, the elderly, the sick, the lonely, the trusted, the cheaters, the perpetrators of violence, and the thieves. At the point at which we enter the story with them in John 6, the large crowd is approaching Jesus on the mountain. And as deep as their theological questions are, the urgency of anger, and as much as people needed to be healed and helped through the big circumstances that were upending their lives, we are confronted with what is literally one of the most basic human needs. They are hungry. And in some ways, this is actually very annoying. Have you ever been on a deadline in the middle of work so important that stopping for something like a meal feels like a waste? Or when you're walking through hellish circumstances and you're making big decisions, the fact that you need to feed your family again for the third time today is just completely overwhelming. I have this memory of driving down High Street in a storm in something of a hungry haze. I don't remember the circumstances exactly. I think it was right after the death of a family member, during a housing crisis and a simultaneous medical emergency. We were moving multiple big rocks at once and making quick decisions, and there was what felt like unending physical labor. I wanted food that would satisfy my hunger and actually give us the nutrients we needed to do the work that we were doing. And the work of just figuring out like what food could do that and where I could go and get it at that particular part of the street that I was in completely took all of my energy. Maybe some in the crowd were there just because they were into the drama of the moment and wanted to see what would happen and what people would say. But for the crowd to be there in the first place, there were driving, motivating factors. And now, despite those, blood sugars are dropping while overtired children get increasingly wild, and the elderly who probably shouldn't have come up the mountain in the first place position themselves by a rock or tree or just a place in the shade. This is the moment where crowds go wild and where they become dangerous. And then, like a messy and uninvited guest, they show up. Not to Jesus' home or the temple, not near some places with resources and a market, on a mountain, they show up in the thousands. Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get just a little." One of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they among so many people?" Now, I'll be honest. I know that geography can do things, and I don't particularly understand the acoustics of exactly how it would work for Jesus to address a gathered crowd in the thousands. But I feel pretty confident asserting that this conversation that John gives us a window into was not heard by the crowd. It's a discussion between Jesus and his disciples. I'm betting that many in the crowd didn't even see them talking. Some might have seen an exchange and wondered what it was about. What was Jesus going to do now that they were all there? Or at least many of them, as I'm betting some of them were still probably on their way. A few probably caught a glimpse as to what was going on. Maybe especially the one person that is individually identified as part of the crowd, the boy. Now, there's no backstory here. We're left to imagine the circumstances that brought this particular child to Jesus. Was he traveling with family, alone, asked to pay attention and come back with stories? What we do have, though, is a hint as to his socioeconomic status because the loaves were made of barley, which, according to New Testament scholar Raymond Brown, was a grain commonly available to the poor. This suggests the child's social location was with the poor. Andrew's speech gestures towards the inadequacy of the child's food. There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they among so many people? He's not suggesting that they take the meal. He's pointing out the contrast between need and resource. It seems likely that the child was nearby, quite possibly within earshot. And this is where the miracle begins. Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. Then Jesus took the loaves. Jesus gives his disciples a job. They are to act like security at a concert or a parade. Move with order, be still, let people rest, let them see me. This transition, albeit chaotic, would indicate to the crowd some kind of movement. I think it would grow anticipation. If Jesus is sending his disciples to make order to sit down, he must be getting ready to do something. And still, there is the boy. Andrew comments on the boy's food, and then Jesus takes the food. The tenor and tone of the story, as well as what we know of the person of Jesus, would suggest that Jesus did not forcefully take the food. I wonder if, once noticed by Jesus and his disciples, the boy offered his provisions to the man who healed on the Sabbath and had proclaimed himself to be the Son of God. What a special moment for the boy, a poor child with nothing but the provisions present in a poor household, suddenly noticed and with something valuable to give as an offering. I have something Jesus can use. Take it. John doesn't give us the conversation between the boy and Jesus. Maybe the boy offered the food outright. Maybe Jesus asked for it. Maybe after people were seated, Jesus came over and just took it, but not like a, "I'm taking it," like, "Give me a minute, I'll be right back." I think any of them would have been overwhelming and exciting for the poor child who was able to offer something valuable to Jesus, even though what he had would hardly have been considered much in any other circumstance. But it is all that he had. In any case, the contrast is astronomical. We live in a social context that lifts up what the theologian Willie Jennings calls the vision of the self-sufficient man. This person, this man, is one who is self-directed, never apologizing for his strength or ability or knowledge, one who recognizes his own power and uses it wisely, one bound in courage, moral vision, singularity of purpose, and not given to the extremes of anger or desire. This is the image that we hold on to in our collective consciousness as wise, esteemed leaders. Think presidents, dead long enough that we no longer remember their geopolitical sins, striking a solemn pose in a leather chair, whose stories are bound and recounted in little golden books with folklore-like grandeur. It's the quintessential image of the Ivy League scholar, the sort that parents and students pine for when caught up in competitive cycles of youth achievement. This image grips us, and as seemingly compelling as it is, it's not Christ-like. Now, the violating principle here is not courage, moral vision, purpose, emotional regulation, strength, ability, or knowledge. It's these things bound up in self-reliance and self-sufficiency. It presupposes that these traits are acquirable entities, things we can master, grip, and put in our pockets. It's a shimmery malformation in the seed of colonialist conquest. The Son of God, Son of Man, Jesus, confronted by a hangry crowd of thousands on a mountain, he who was and is perfect and bounding in love did not use his power to overpower, even in a benevolent and gentle way. And he did not create food from nothing, though surely he could have. Jesus hosted the boy and the crowd by taking what was offered from a poor child and turning it into provision for thousands. Jesus is Jesus, and the child is the child, and yet in this miracle, Jesus provides out what was made available through his relationship with the child. Surely Jesus embodies courage, moral vision, purpose, emotional regulation, strength, ability, and knowledge. But in these things, he knits God's creation together. God made our good world, and God longs for communion with all creation, including the boy, including the crowd, including us. Therefore, in Jesus, we see God leaning toward people and into relationship. And again, he's picked the least among the people around him. Jesus picked the poor boy. And it is with that offering and through that relationship that he will feed the bellies and at least for a moment still and upend the expectation, opinions, and gossip of the whole crowd. I can only imagine what it must have felt like to walk, stand, and eventually sit in the mountain field, longing for Jesus, longing for the particular miracle that you knew you needed in your life, and to do so knowing that there was no way you could ever make your way to the front of the crowd, no way that you could get to him, and yet wanting him and wanting help so badly. And to these people, every single one of them, Jesus performed a miracle that affirmed his love and care and showed that he knew who they were. The food offered to each of these desperate people was the result of miraculous multiplication. It might not have been the miracle that these people expected, but each and every one of them was able to go home and say that Jesus saw me today and he made enough food for me to have my fill. Jesus took the loaves from the boy and gave thanks to God for them. And he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up. And from the fragments of 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. This is my favorite part of the whole story. Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost. Jesus not only took the boy's offering of loaves and fishes and multiplied it enough times to feed a sold-out crowd at a home crew game, because it was 5,000 men plus women and children. He doesn't waste any part of the multiplied offering. And at the end of the unplanned food operation of massive scale for a vulnerable and volatile crowd, Jesus insists on ending it well. His disciples are sent back to collect the leftovers, the fragments. I imagine that some of it was kept as provision for the journey that Jesus and his disciples were on, and that most of it was sent home with the boy and people like him, because Jesus is on the side of the poor. And he's in the business of feeding people. He's unwilling to waste any part of the boy's gift, unwilling to let an untidy crowd leave the food behind or in some kind of mess. There is order, quite literally administration. Collecting the fragments is an administrative task, but it's also what a host does. Gathering the fragments is a way of maintaining order and cleanliness and preventing wastefulness. It's a way of maintaining a welcome space. Now, welcome can easily become a trite concept. It can be reduced to just coffee or a sterile handshake and the little wooden signs in the houseware aisles at Marshall's. But it is so much more than that. Welcome is a place, an entry place for relationships, both new and established. And while the 15 minutes before service might not be the place where we usually break down and share our deepest hopes and worries, it is the place with the stories of JV soccer and middle school production of Guys and Dolls and chatter about being overwhelmed at work and the excitement of an upcoming vacation. And it makes a difference how we show up in spaces of welcome. The best example of welcome I know happened last summer. My family and I were at the Vineyards National Conference in North Carolina, and Thomas and I had signed up for a brief prophetic prayer ministry session. We signed up together, which means we needed childcare for literally 20 minutes. Now, we knew a handful of other people at the conference, and so we asked over a group text thread who might be available to watch Edith, then 2 years old, for 20 minutes. Y'all, Jordan Gullo volunteered. And I should say, I'm sharing this story with both his permission and Edith's. Now, if you don't know Jordan, you should. He's a really nice guy. On certain weeks, he's the person in the back of the sanctuary making coffee here at the church. On weekdays, you can find him on all manner of build-it and fix-it jobs in people's homes. I don't think he had ever spent time with Edith before. They had no history or relationship, but it was 20 minutes, and Jordan's a good guy, so it seemed fine. We left Jordan and Edith by some cozy chairs in the lobby outside the room Thomas and I were praying in. We armed Jordan with a stroller, a bag of snacks, and a Ziploc bag full of toddler toys. And I don't know what happened while I was gone, but when I came back, Jordan and Edith were like this. That's cool, she's two. They had fun, I'm glad it worked out, it was great. Except since then, Edith has seen Jordan regularly at church and the occasional social function. That's it. But he is still her buddy, a preferred person for high fives. Last fall, I started prepping her for the holidays so she'd know what to expect and could distinguish Thanksgiving from Christmas, that kind of thing. And as soon as I explained what Thanksgiving was, her first response was, "And Jordan is coming?" It was straight out of the blue. And she asked for weeks, "And Jordan is coming?" She asked so many times, Jordan came. Friends, Jordan doesn't have, like, magic little kid glue that draws Edith in every time he sees her. He gave 20 minutes of honest-to-goodness caregiving attention to another human, made a connection, and that was it. Because of that, even though Edith only sees Jordan here and there at church, he's a safe adult to her. As a parent, I've signaled that to her, and she's experienced it herself. And that makes him trustworthy. And friends, that opens doors. A few weeks ago, Edith and I came forward for the Eucharist near the end of service, and you should know the bread in the cup is like her favorite part about church. And as we were walking to our seats, we passed Jordan, who was standing in that corner, available for prayer ministry. And so I said to my three-year-old, "Do you want Jordan to pray for you? He can pray for us together." And she said yes. It was so sweet and tender. And that's the formation as a kid grows up in church. It's key. She's learned that we pray at home, at dinner, and before bed. We thank God and we ask God for help, and that's good. But when she prays with Mom and Jordan at church, she learns that prayer involves a wider community of people. There's a wider circle of hope than what she yet knows, and she is beloved. But the only way that was accessible to her, as it is the only way that it is accessible to all of us, not just children, is through people who show us kindness and care about our lives. The deeper places are opened up through exchanges of welcome and hospitality. Welcome is the first part of our Sunday morning liturgy. And welcome doesn't actually begin on the stage. It starts around 9:45. I'll say that's the time that the coffee set up by, so there's that, but it's not the coffee that creates the welcome. People do, in partnership with the Spirit. And you know who's in this building at like 9:45, 9:50? Guests. Guests are welcomed before service. Welcome continues with the formal beginning of worship when the liturgist takes the stage as Jared did today and reads from something like Psalm 95, "Oh come, let us sing to the Lord," or whatever the daily reading is. It's not performative or something that we just do because it's because they are the literal words from Scripture about preparing for worship. They proclaim God's goodness and explain what's going to happen next and offer it as an invitation for all to come along for. Because worship isn't something that we just enter into as individuals, it's for the whole community. Well-rested, overtired, lifetime attender, first-time guest, person on the edge of faith ready to let go, and the person who already has. We are not as different from the crowd that Jesus addressed in John 6 as we might imagine. And then finally, it seems important to say too, while welcome is often an act of hospitality stationed near the beginnings, it is not there exclusively. Welcome is something that we are invited into anytime others join our space together. Within the context of our Sunday morning liturgy, that happens before service and at the beginning of service, and friends, it's going to happen again in about 3 minutes. Welcome is written into the script of our worship here in CV in the most literal way. When parents greet their kids, welcome the space as the sermon is ending and ministry time is beginning, and we pivot into song and prayer. And while maybe the older ones come in solemnly and just slip in, and that's beautiful and fine, some of the younger children are prone to running and grabbing their parents' arms and legs and throwing in front of them the craft or coloring sheet representing whatever the lesson was in the kids' teaching time today. That moment of feet scurrying about and chair finding is as smooth and as loud as a 7-year-old asking mom to sit with her best friend on the other side of the sanctuary, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Welcome happens before service and actually through our attitudes, our body language, and our willingness to make space for the loud 7-year-old and her friends. Welcome happens partway through, too. And for the sake of the kids and our relationship with them as adults and teens in this church, hopefully that welcome can happen with the kind of love that Jordan offered Edith. My hope in this talk is that we would see and understand welcome as a deeply theological concept that Jesus practiced, and that he practiced right here in John 6. That we would understand why welcome is part of our liturgy at CV and respond with an invitation to show up as we are and participate in it. And that we would see and understand welcome as a practice of hospitality with relevance to every part of our lives. In a few moments, we're going to transition into a time of prayer ministry. And as we do so, I want to invite you to just think about a few questions. Jesus left the physical place where gossip and anger were stirred up after he healed a very sick man on the Sabbath and said he was the Son of God. He retreated to the mountain where this crowd caught up with him, and he offered the crowd welcome and hospitality. What invitation might God have for us to experience and receive welcome when we are tired? Jesus responds to the crowd's presence by meeting a literal presenting need, hungry bellies. I would invite parents to head on to the back and collect your kids. What do we hold back from relationships when being welcomed and hosted in a space? And as hosts who seek to welcome, what do we fail to notice? In what ways might our community's practice and experience of welcome mature in light of Jesus' example in John 6?